Let's all go to the
Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come, join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
Ow!
Does that hurt, Sage? When I press there?
Ah, yes. Stop touching my tooth, Projectionist!
Quit your howling, Victor. I believe, though, your tooth is shattered.
I know it's shattered. I told you it was.
I felt it wise to check to be sure. Yes. You will have to have that removed, and soon.
I assumed that, Projectionist. Hey, what are you hiding behind your back?
Oh, these are some pliers we had laying around the control room. I would be more than happy to help you extract that jagged protrusion.
That's okay, man. I think I'll just make an appointment with a dentist.
That will teach you to crack popcorn kernels between those aging teeth of yours, eh?
Yeah, that's for sure. As well as not eating any more popcorn you made for me. It was practically a bag full of buttered kernels. Hey, on the control panel, the recording light is on. Welcome back, friends, to the Saturday Frights Podcast.
If there are still dear listeners out there, your pitiful synopsis for Tales from the Dark Sides, The Odds, appears to have finally forced our audience to change the dial on the radios.
Hey, I've been semi-retired, Projectionist. I'm sure it's a case that some of our listeners do not know we've sort of returned yet.
Whatever helps you sleep at night, Victor?
Well, friends, as you can tell, things are pretty much back to normal here in the Retroist Vault. At least between the Projectionist and myself. Minus the shattered tooth, of course. The rebuilding of the vault is done, and the staff of Retros Incorporated are back at work.
My wing is not quite complete. Soon, though, all will be ready.
I've shared a few photos of what intern Rockford Jay and myself have found in the entrance to your wing, my friend. It doesn't exactly make us feel comfortable. Moving on. This time, listeners, we're going to be tackling a classic Twilight Zone episode from 1960, entitled The Howling Man.
A remarkable example of episodic television, to be sure, dear listeners.
Absolutely. I would say this is probably in the top 10 of greatest Twilight Zone episodes ever. And, considering there aren't too many stumbles in that series, that really is saying something. The Howling Man aired on November 4th, 1960, and was the fifth episode of Season 2. It also marked the first episode of Season 2 that wasn't written by Rod Serling. The script was courtesy of the legendary Charles Beaumont, which was based off the story of the same name that he wrote in 1959.
Charles Beaumont. Yes, the same screenwriter who penned 1963's The Haunted Palace and 1964's The Seven Faces of Dr. Lao.
The one and the same. The story originally appeared in an issue of Rogue, which was a men's magazine of the day. An interesting note, though, his editor at that magazine was Harlan Ellison. And it was published under a pseudonym, which was C.B. Lovehill. The Howling Man was collected in Night Ride and Other Journeys in March of 1960, of the 156 Twilight Zone episodes, Beaumont...
I truly do love the Seven Faces of Dr. Lao. When I originally presented it at the Haunted Drive-In, this was back on... Let me think. It must have been March 18th of 1964. Yes, I am sure that is correct. The second feature was Jack Curtis's The Flesh Eaters.
I like those movies too, projectionist. But back to The Howling Man. Charles Beaumont delivered some really, really great episodes of the Twilight Zone series. 22 episodes in all. And some of those highlights include Long Live Walter Jameson, Long Distance Call, Printer's Devil, and of course, Living Doll. You know, the one with Talkie Tina?
One of your favorite episodes, I would imagine. What with you getting the willies from dolls, eh?
Definitely one that gives me the creeps, my friends. I'm sure at some point we will tackle that classic episode, too. Charles Beaumont has been credited with really leading the charge on the early seasons of The Twilight Zone. And it certainly is easy to see why with some of those episodes I mentioned.
If I remember correctly, he passed away at a very young age, yes?
Sadly, that is true. At the age of 38, in fact. Appearing to rapidly age. I have read that his original literary agent, none other than famous monster of filmlands, Forrest J. Ackerman, has said he felt that Beaumont was stricken with both Alzheimer's disease as well as Pick's disease.
An absolute tragedy, dear listeners. Someone of such talent taken away so soon.
Definitely, projectionist. I suppose this is a case of the flame that burns twice as bright burns half as long. It's horrible, though, that we fans of not just The Twilight Zone, of course, but horror and science fiction stories were robbed of the future stories from Beaumont. In his prolific career between 1950 and 1967, though, he wrote not just those 22 Twilight Zone episodes, but 85 short stories as well, 14 screenplays, 2 novels, and... even 2 issues of the Mickey Mouse comic book with William F. Nolan. To say nothing of the respect he earned from the likes of Richard Matheson, who also was known for more than a few of the more excellent Twilight Zone episodes. There was Ray Bradbury, Robert Bloch, and Harlan Ellison, all staunch supporters of the work of Beaumont. A pretty remarkable legacy, to say the least.
Indeed.
The Howling Man episode differs a little from Beaumont's short story. I suppose we can tackle those differences as we discuss the synopsis.
Assuming, of course, Victor, you ever begin the synopsis, eh?
And you wonder why the HR department is always getting on your case? You must have folders of memos and reminders of how you're supposed to behave by now.
Not as many as you might think. I find they make exceptional kindling for my fireplace.
Well, Beaumont's writing isn't the only reason that The Howling Man stands out. You have a fantastic director in Douglas Hayes, as well as the performances by Friedrich von Liedber as Brother Christophorus, the legendary John Carradine as Brother Jerome, Robin Hughes as the titular Howling Man, and of course, H.M. Wynant as the main protagonist for the episode, David Ellington. Friends, right off the bat, this episode grabs you, as we are introduced to David Ellington, although an aged version, as we will quickly learn.
Do not forget the fact he is wide-eyed and sweating profusely as he addresses the audience, Sage.
Absolutely. He appears to be either crazed, suffering a fever, or is terrified. Perhaps the truth is, it's all three. Wynette really sells his performance. It isn't over the top, and it could have easily been. Of course, it doesn't hurt that as we are introduced to Ellington, it is by the way of a crazy Dutch angle. It totally puts us off. In fact, the entire episode continuously features multiple Dutch angles throughout.
I know it's It's an incredible story. I of all people know this. And you won't believe me, no, not at first. But I'm going to tell you the whole thing. Then you will believe, because you must. You must believe. It happened many years ago, after the First World War. I was on a walking trip through Central Europe. Well, one night, I got lost in a storm.
In the 1959 short story, David is actually on a biking tour of Europe after the First World War. Like you could hear in that clip, though, when Ellington is pleading with us to believe him, and he begins to recount his tale, it is very much a stormy night.
As it was when David Ellington, in his youth, chanced upon a bastion of safety, having lost his way in the wilderness, to find a hermitage, a place to seek shelter from the violent thunderstorm around him.
Definitely. Ellington doesn't appear to be in the best of shape, as he all but collapses against the large oak door to the hermitage. While we aren't told how long David has been lost, it is long enough for him to have possibly caught pneumonia.
Not that the hermitage is quick to open their doors to this stranger.
Not in the least, projectionist. After banging on the oak doors, we viewers are introduced to Brother Christophorus, a rather imposing figure, friends, especially as he is lighted by a lantern in one hand, his impassive gaze.
Looming glare, do you not, Sage?
Good point. As I was saying, though, the brother holds a lantern in one hand and a large shepherd's staff in the other. His size and demeanor, well, he looks ready to physically block anyone who might want to enter the hermitage.
Dear listeners, I know many of you that tune into our radio program are indeed fans of classic films. You will know the actor, Friedrich von Liedberg, who plays Brother Christophorus, better as Queequeg from 1956's Moby Dick.
Yes! I thought that was him. Anyway, thankfully for David, while the giant of a man blocking his way looks impassive, when he sees how sick this stranger truly is, he allows him in.
Not to stay, though. At least not until he has discussed it with the head of their order, Brother Jerome.
True, but it is a momentary respite from the raging storm outside, to which David is quite grateful. As he is led into the hermitage, a place that appears to have no comforts of civilization.
It is a hermitage, Victor. Do you expect the viewers to see the brothers crowded around a jukebox and drinking malts?
No, sorry. That was a funny image. Of course not. I meant there's no running water or electricity. The hermitage is cold stone and old. There are buckets scattered about to collect the rain where it's dripping. Ellington leans against a stone column while Brother Christophorus is off explaining the situation to Brother Jerome. We do get to see other members of the order at this point. They, too, are rather imposing, standing outside the doors of their rooms, silently, also carrying large shepherd staffs.
It would appear, however, there is one other in the hermitage, unseen, but easily heard.
The Howling Man. As you can imagine, David is quite terrified by what he hears.
The stoic Brother Christophorus appears to inform David Ellington that the head of the order will see him.
David is obviously more concerned by that terrible sound, to which the brother replies it was only the wind. The young man's meeting with Brother Jerome, who bears a striking resemblance to Moses, is probably not what he was expecting.
Agreed. David Ellington is seeking only shelter and possibly some food, but is told in no uncertain terms that he must leave the hermitage immediately.
Which naturally comes as a shock, but to David's credit, is something he attempts to do. Fate has other plans, however, as the young man takes a few steps and then succumbs to his illness, falling face first to the stone floor and passing out. Upon waking, it appears that the brothers have taken mercy on him. I mean, at least they didn't just toss his unconscious form out into the storm.
It would have been better for the world if they had.
Wow, that's rather harsh.
The truth hurts, Victor.
David appears to have gotten a little energy back, but he hears that strange howling again and finds himself compelled to go and investigate. It seems to be coming from a locked door. A long shepherd's crook is placed across it, like an iron bar during a siege in medieval times. At the top of the door, however, is a window grill, and within the room, it's no animal or monster, but a very scruffy and terribly frightened man. Seeing David, this, well, what appears to be a prisoner, reaches through the window grill and grips his shoulder, like a drowning man would a life preserver. The look of hope and anguish on the howling man's face is very touching as he quickly begins to speak.
Help me! No, please, in the name of mercy, help me. You're not one of them.
No. My name's Ellington. I'm an American.
Shh. We have only moments. Come closer. Come. They're mad, Mr. Ellington. All of them. Raving mad. Listen, I was in the village in Swartzop. I was walking in the street with my woman. We paused to rest by a tree, and we kissed. Is it wrong to kiss? Tell me.
I don't think so.
Of course you don't. You don't think so, and I don't think so. But Jerome, the lecherous old fool, we looked up. And I saw him standing close by. I tried to open my mouth to speak, but before I could utter a sound, he raised that heavy staff he carries. You've seen it? And he hit me again and again. This is not a religious order, Mr. Ellington. These so-called brothers of truth, they're outcasts, misfits, cut off from the world because the world won't have them. Mr. Ellington, please, you must believe me. I don't say they're evil. I say they're mad.
This is how David learns he may have more to worry about than his fever. If the Brothers of Truth are capable of keeping a man prisoner for the sin of kissing his beloved, can the young man be sure that he too won't end up in a cell like the Howling Man?
That is, of course, if this unkempt man is telling the truth.
The hermitage isn't that big, so David is caught talking to the Howling Man and sent to Brother Jerome's room once again. Just like before, the elderly brother is quick to make it clear that the hermitage has no place for Ellington and he needs to leave at once.
Although this time, the young American is having nothing of it. This time, he takes control of the situation, agreeing to leave the sanctuary and return to town. As well as informing the constables of the poor man being held prisoner. Nothing like a little blackmail to get to the point.
The news of the possibility of police being involved does seem to shake Jerome quite a bit. Still, when David asks who the man is in the cell, Brother Jerome is adamant that there is no man held prisoner, nor has there ever been such a thing done in the hermitage. Obviously, Ellington is getting annoyed and angrily insists he knows for a fact he was talking to a man in a cell just a few minutes ago. As if on cue, the Howling Man wails off screen. And we can't help but notice Brother Jerome this time covers his ears. Ellington seems to be relieved by this action. It proves he isn't hallucinating or crazy after all. Wearily, Jerome nods and admits that he does hear the howls from the prisoner of the hermitage. John Carradine has this wonderful line as he admits it, though. He says, "As I've heard it, every hour of every day for 5 long years."
The skills of John Carradine are impressive, dear listeners. It is not merely his delivery that is impressive, but his body language as well. Granted, he was 50 years old when playing the part of Brother. Father Jerome, but with his white head of hair and beard, he manages to somehow convey a far younger man, aged prematurely due to the burden he bears.
Well said, my friend. Listeners, Brother Jerome lets all pretense of being stoic and all hopes of subterfuge slide off him. He seems somehow rejuvenated, actually, with not having to lie any longer. Although David isn't quite ready for the answer the head of the Brothers of Truth has to give him.
But this isn't a religious order, is it, brother?
We feel that we are recognized by God. Truth is our dogma. We believe it to be man's greatest weapon against the devil, who is the father of all lies. At that time, shortly after the Great War, the world was in chaos. Everywhere was unhappiness, except in this little village below. For some reason, the people of Schwarzhof refused to yield to despair. They lost none of their faith. They continued as they had been for centuries, honest, God-fearing, and happy. This village was a plum to Satan, one he could not resist. So he came here and embarked upon a program of corruption.
But you stopped.
Yes! You see, Mr. Ellington, he made the same mistake that you have made. He underestimated me. He thought he would have no difficulty in tempting the old fool. But I had him in a cell before he knew what happened.
But if he's the devil, how do you keep him locked up?
With the staff for truth. The one barrier he cannot pass.
Now, David has just heard something I believe we would all consider a wild story. Brother Jerome, though, appears to be glad that he can finally reveal everything. The reason the world has known peace, 5 years of it since World War I, is because the devil has been locked in the Hermitage. David, of course, points out that man is still very much suffering. There's famine, murder, corruption. But Jerome, speaking as if to his own son, explains these are the woes that man was meant to endure. Not global war, though. Genocide. That is the result of the thing in the cell.
Victor, Brother Jerome also offers some very real advice, as he mentions. We cause most of our own griefs. We need no help from him.
That is a great line. The impassioned plea of Brother Jerome appears to have swayed David. He promises he will not tell anyone of what he knows about the Hermitage. Jerome is obviously relieved by this news and asks the young man to head to Brother Christophorus's room. In the morning, he can leave in peace, if he is feeling well enough, that is. Although, doubt remains. Granted, how could it not? David takes a moment to wander towards the Howling Man's cell. The man within looks upon Ellington sadly and remarks he can already tell Jerome has lied to David. He can see it plainly on the young man's face. David admits that he doesn't believe the elderly man and offers to go ahead and go get the authorities. The Howling Man, though, pleads with him not to do so, as the Brothers of Truth will make sure there is no evidence by the time the police arrive.
Witch's Wind, Brother Christophorus, appears to guide David Ellington to his own room, going so far as to lock the heavy oak door behind him as he settles in for the night.
David asks why the door's being locked, and is informed by the imposing brother that it is for his own safety.
An attempt for David Ellington to not to do something foolish, eh?
Yes, actually that is exactly the point. But Brother Christophorus is only human. He has to sleep, which is the moment David waits for, as he has already made up his mind to free the poor Howling Man. Grabbing a cloak, since the rain is coming down, he carefully removes the key from around the brother's neck, making sure to lock the door again, to ensure that Christophorus won't be able to get out. As he reaches the Howling Man's cell door, the poor man within is obviously relieved beyond belief, asking for him to quickly remove the bolt from the door, the wooden shepherd's staff. Friends, no lock exists on that door, just the staff.
Naturally, David Ellington asks if this was the only thing keeping the man within. After all, he clearly could reach through that window grill and remove it himself.
The prisoner insists they have no time. If they do not leave, and quickly, the Brothers of Truth will surely kill them both for this act. David grips the staff with both hands and lifts it, swinging the door wide and letting the Howling Man free. The young man hands the cloak to the freed man as he turns to head to the exit. The prisoner sweeps the cape over his hunched shoulders and stares at David, before lifting his hand in an odd gesture, which causes Ellington to freeze up before dropping to the stone floor. Satisfied with this act, the Howling Man immediately changes. And listeners, I need to stress, this change is done in camera. His complexion slightly darkens, and with a satisfied smile, strokes his beard as he strolls casually past Ellington on the floor. The young man attempts to lift himself from the floor, and his face says it all. He knows what he has done now. He has been played the fool and released the devil back upon the world. As the Howling Man passes the columns of the Hermitage, staring straight at we the viewers, I might add, he changes over and over. His nose extends, his ears grow pointy, horns begin to protrude from his head, until he stands before the open windows of the Abbey. With one more grin at his tricking of David, he pulls his cloak about him and vanishes in a puff of brimstone. Brother Christophorus and Jerome quickly race to David's side. You might think they would be angry with him, but Jerome looks upon Ellington with such a great deal of pity. He leans down and places a comforting hand on his shoulder, saying, "I am sorry for you, my son. All your life you will remember this night, and you'll know, Mr. Ellington, whom you have turned loose upon the world."
David Ellington apologizes for not believing Brother Jerome. Naturally. The elderly man doesn't condemn him, however. He reminds him that it has always been man's weakness to not recognize the devil before him.
That isn't the end of the story, though. We return to modern day, to the older version of David that began the story. It turns out he devoted his life to trying to track down and trap the devil once again, which he has done. Also, he isn't telling we viewers the story, but his housekeeper. Why? Because he wants her to understand that everything that has happened since with World War II and the Korean War, his mistake has finally been corrected. As in the next room, behind a closed door, with a small version of the Staff of Truth blocking the door, awaits the Howling Man. David must leave, though, and make arrangements to have the Brothers of Truth come collect the devil. Ellington is warning the housekeeper that no matter what she might hear, she must not open that door.
Dear listeners, I'm sure you know, however, what happens as soon as David Ellington leaves his home. The howling begins, and the frightened woman hesitantly lifts the Staff of Truth from the door. It swings wide open, and we are witness to the darkness waiting within the room as the esteemed Rod Serling leaves us with this thought. Ancient folk saying, you can catch the devil, but you can't hold him long. Ask Brother Jerome. Ask David Ellington. They know, and they'll go on knowing to the end of their days and beyond, in the Twilight Zone.
And friends, that is the synopsis for The Howling Man. One of the things I love about this episode, besides the acting, is throughout, multiple characters repeat the line of, "You must believe me." A very nice bit of writing from Beaumont for all the characters involved. Ellington, Brother Jerome, and of course, the devil plead to be believed.
You might have noticed as well that the devil, when begging, always says, "In the name of mercy." Obviously, he won't say "in the name of God," eh?
I kind of got wrapped up in the synopsis, friends, and forgot to mention some things that were different in the original story and screenplay. Maybe we'll go backwards here. For one thing, in Beaumont's story, David Ellington didn't go after the devil after releasing him. He instead receives a postcard one day after so much strife with World War II and the Korean War from Brother Christophorus, who writes, "Rest now, my son. we have him back with us again. In fact, in the 1959 story, it is left up to the readers to decide if David truly did release the devil. Although, I believe it is strongly hinted at. After freeing the Howling Man, by the way, there's no staff of truth barring the door, just a good old-fashioned iron lock. The duo run from the Hermitage, but David falls as they're passing through town, and fearing that the brothers will indeed kill him, begs for help from the freed man, who just sneers at him and runs away.
I recall reading that the Brothers of Truth, in the original screenplay, were meant to carry not staffs with them, but crosses?
Yeah, that is totally true. It was supposed to be a cross barring the door of the Howling Man, although director Douglas Hayes rightfully realized that it would probably cause controversy if that was filmed. This was something that Charles Beaumont wasn't exactly happy with. The same rings true of the sounds of the Howling Man. In the short story, it is horrible screaming and crying. I'm going to read a little excerpt from Mark Scott Zachary's The Twilight Zone Companion, in which he was able to interview Douglas Hayes. Quote, "The howling aspects of the thing were hard to sell," Hayes recalls. "Now, when you mention howling in a story, you hear this crazy howling off in the distance all the time. This man in the cell is howling. That's all right in a story. Very hard to translate to the screen. It's hard to believe that a man who's in that cell would make those howling noises. I don't think we ever actually saw him howling. We only heard him, because to see him howling would have been very, very hard to buy." End quote. By the way, friends, if you are a Twilight Zone fan, you owe it to yourself to pick up The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Scott Zachary. It is filled with amazing facts and interviews with those that were in front of and behind the camera on those classic Twilight Zone episodes. Another element that Beaumont had written in his screenplay for the episode was a more subtler way of revealing the Howling Man as the devil. Apparently, the writer wanted the viewers to briefly see the prisoner escaping through the window, with a cloven hoof evident. Charles Beaumont felt it would be better to see on Ellington's face the transformation of the freed man into the devil. Douglas Hayes, however, felt the audience would feel a little cheated if they didn't see a full transformation. In this case, I think I actually agree with Douglas Hayes. Projectionist, did you happen to bring any vintage ads to share with the viewers this time?
You know I did, Sage. I was even able to locate an appropriate television clip for this episode. A clip that was housed here in the Retro's vault.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Down this hall is a very strange individual locked in a room. He's known by various names and by various forms. And next week on the Twilight Zone, you'll be close to the elbow of the people who let him out. Our story is called The Howling Man by Mr. Charles Beaumont. It's designed for the young in heart but the strong of nerve. I hope we'll see you next week along with The Howling Man. Thank you and good night.
Friends, director Douglas Hayes was no stranger to TV series and TV movies, having written and directed for both. Some of those that stand out in his career include The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, Maverick. He directed 9 episodes of The Twilight Zone, such as The Invaders, Eye of the Beholder, and Nervous Man in a $4 Room, to name a few. He also directed a segment of The Night Gallery, entitled The Dead Man. Friedrich von Liedber, I hope we haven't butchered his name throughout this episode, besides appearing in Moby Dick, was also in The Buccaneer, The Blue Max, as well as the underappreciated Sorcerer from 1977 with Roy Scheider. I am very happy to say that H.M. Wynette is still very much alive. With 160 acting credits to his name, he's appeared in the likes of The Wild Wild West, Mannix, The Rockford Files, The Horror at 37,000 Feet, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and he's even performed in 2 of the Twilight Zone radio dramas. Last, but certainly not least, is John Carradine, truly a legend in the acting business. This is a man who amassed 351 acting credits to his name. Some highlights from such an illustrious career include 1939's Stagecoach, 1940's The Grapes of Wrath, 1956, The Ten Commandments, which might be where he got that look as Moses for his character of Brother Jerome. But he was also in so many Universal Monster films. The Mummy's Ghost, House of Frankenstein, and House of Dracula. They truly broke the mold when they made John Carradine, and his family has continued to carry that tradition, as he was the father of Chris, Bruce, David, Keith, and Robert Carradine, as well as being the grandfather to Martha Plimpton, Ever Carradine, and Kansas Carradine.
Hey Vic, projectionist. I hope I'm not interrupting.
Not at all, man. The projectionist and myself were just finishing up the new Saturday Frights podcast.
Rockford J just delivered a box meant for you, and the guys in the mailroom couldn't help but notice that there's a voice coming from inside, which is not normally where voices come from, so we opened it.
My name is Talkie Tina, and I think I could even hate you.
Kill it. Kill it with fire, please.
Great, it's loose. And now it's choking Rockford J.
My name is Talkie Tina, and you better be nice to me.
Attention, Retroist Vault members. It is a code orange. I repeat, another talking evil doll is loose. Please report to the nearest panic room. I repeat, this is a code orange. Another evil talking doll is loose in the facilities. Have a nice day.
I'm sure everything would be fine.
Friends, on behalf of the projectionist and myself, thank you for taking the time to listen to us discuss The Howling Man. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retrowest.com. My co-host, the projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He generally shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements a couple times a week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. Our newest intern is Rockford J. Not only can you find him every day sharing his own love of retro horror on the Saturday Frights Facebook page, but you can also totally find him on Facebook. We are so glad he and Preston Griffith decided to join the Saturday Frights team. I'm so glad that both of them keep their insurance up to date, friends. It can be kind of dangerous working here. As for myself, while I am still semi-retired from writing and podcasting, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcasts, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit The Retroist. If you like the show, consider giving us a rating over on iTunes to help spread the word. On the next Saturday Frights podcast, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about George A. Romero. Until next time, the vault is sealed. This has been a Retroist production. Thank you for listening, and have a better one. Goodbye.